From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent Gallup poll asking Americans about their views on socialism found that 43% felt that some version of it would be good for the country. That's a marked shift from earlier years and a strong counterargument to Republicans and centrist Democrats who feel there is no appetite for socialism in the U.S. Even capitalist leaders are admitting their methods have failed. The Business Roundtable released a statement recently signed by nearly 200 CEOs of major corporations re-evaluating the fact that a company's top priority ought to be maximizing shareholder profits. The CEOs declared Americans deserve an economy that allows each person to succeed through hard work and creativity and to lead a life of meaning and dignity. As the U.S. slides closer to a recession, sparked at least in part by Trump's trade war with China, the question arises, is Trump failing capitalism or is capitalism failing us? Joining me to help answer that question is Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University in New York and professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Welcome back to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm glad to be here.
So first, let's talk about what it is that Trump is doing with the economy and his sort of pro-business standard approach to what's happening in China. He seems to be applying this method that maybe has worked in the corporate world of pushing every boundary, whether it's legal or not, to get what he wants, leveraging everything he can, throwing confusion, contradicting himself to bully the other side into getting what he wants. And he certainly doesn't want to admit that his actions are impacting the U.S. economy. Do you feel that you can lay the blame for the recession indicators at Trump's feet?
Well, he certainly deserves part of the blame. He certainly has made the international economy very much more volatile, very much more unpredictable, very much more unstable. And when you add that to the intrinsic instability of capitalism, you have a very dangerous combination. I should say a word about recessions, lest we be misunderstood about all of this. Capitalism is an extraordinarily unstable system. If you start in the 18th century with capitalism becoming the dominant economic system in England and then spreading to the continent of Europe and eventually covering the whole world, you very quickly discover that everywhere and at all times where capitalism becomes the dominant system, you suddenly have what did not exist before, a regular periodic downturn, recession, depression, crisis. We have many words because this situation recurs on average every 4 to 7 years. But since that's an average, you can sometimes have a shorter interval or a longer interval. In addition to nature, which can cause economic upsets, and to wars, which can do that, capitalism adds something bizarre, a regular crash. Suddenly, large numbers of people are thrown out of work. Large numbers of businesses either cut back or declare bankruptcy. You know, we all know, because we went through it in 2008 and 2009, and we're barely coming out of it now, and the next one is hot on our heels. So Mr. Trump can't be blamed for something that happens in all countries and throughout the history of capitalism in America. What he can be blamed for is pretending, as so many presidents have, that what I just said isn't the case, or pretending that even if it was, everything is new and different now, and we don't have to worry about what has always been the case. Whatever his reasoning, by going on a trade war offensive, not just against Mexico and Canada, but mainly now against China, but also India and Europe and so on, he is definitely making it likely that the recession will come sooner rather than later and will last longer rather than shorter and will hurt us more deeply than it might otherwise have done.
Let's turn to what it is that we're seeing CEOs say now, not specifically about the China trade war. Of course, they're extremely nervous about it. They've made it clear they don't like that instability. But I mentioned the Business Roundtable, which is a collection or sort of a coalition of leading corporate executives who have put out a statement that I thought was quite remarkable. For many years now, we have been told that shareholder profit is the top priority for a corporation, and that somehow magically things like human rights and democracy and wages, good wages and labor rights will sort themselves out if profits are put at the center or at the very top of the priority list. How significant is the statement by the Business Roundtable that re-evaluates this set of priorities?
Well, like with all good questions, Sonali, the answer is yes and no. Let me explain. By all means, it is an interesting recognition by leading executives of the change in the attitude of the American people. In your introduction, you correctly pointed to these remarkable polls, the Gallup poll, other polls, that indicate that, especially among young people, it's now a 50-50 split in whether people prefer socialism to capitalism, which is a very dramatic change. It doesn't take very long, and I have access to this information because I'm a teacher of relatively young people. It doesn't take very long for us to discover that this statement is really less about socialism and more about capitalism. Capitalism being the system we have, young people are increasingly disgusted by the gap between what that reality is and what they were led to expect by their parents, their teachers, and older people, namely that if they worked hard and did well in school, a good job and a good income and a secure job would be theirs pretty much as a matter of course. None of that is true. They are saddled not only with job difficulties, but low incomes and unbearable debts. It is a real blow, and they're angry at a system that has disappointed, literally betrayed them. So the corporate executives, they see it, and they know that in the end, their ability to get mammoth profits of the sort they've been getting for the last 30 to 40 years depend on a population that allows that. And the population's attitudes are changing, and they are frightened. That's what that statement is about. They're hoping, as those folks usually do, that some words of this sort, given the proper hype in the news media and so on, will do the trick, will give everybody the idea that they're somehow behaving differently. Frankly, as a citizen of the United States all my life, I would not hold my breath. I don't think this is a genuine change. I am reminded, if you go back and look at American history in the 1950s, when the similar kinds of anxieties were building up and then exploded in the 1960s, that corporations were making statements about the need for, and I didn't make this up, the soulful corporation. Corporations, they said to themselves, must have souls, S-O-U-L, you know, like in religion.
And they something like George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism?
Exactly. It's the same thematic. Promise something, hope that people will take it seriously and not actually ask you to do something. Here's why another reason for skepticism exists. Probably the most famous conservative economics leader in the United States over the last half century was a man named Milton Friedman, who taught economics at the University of Chicago and who was awarded for all of what he did, a Nobel Prize. He is famous for saying that economics teaches that corporations should, as a matter of both morality and self-interest, maximize profits for shareholders. He gave it the kind of stamp of approval of a senior Nobel Prize winning economist. And so I think it became the settled wisdom of the corporate elite. And they're worried now that the looming recession, that the out-of-control government of Mr. Trump, who parades around as the buddy of a CEO whenever he can find one, that this is getting them into deeper and deeper trouble as the population shifts its attitude. So yes, it's remarkable because it shows that they see it, but it is unfortunately very little guarantee that you'll have much more than lip service.
There was an AP article just this week showing how young Americans are warming to socialism, even among Miami Cubans, which is very interesting because you are seeing these rifts apparently within families where older folks are telling their kids, we escaped, we ran from, you know, Cuba's communism. And here you are talking positively about socialism. And some of these young folks are seeing the failures of capitalism and are becoming more and more attracted to socialism. Do you see, and many of them are supporters of Bernie Sanders, who identifies himself as a democratic socialist, do you see the candidacies of people like Bernie Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren, who says she's a capitalist but has some programs that are very similar to his, and the popularity of these two candidates as yet another indication that Americans are more and more ready for a different way?
Yes, I do. But I would go even back a bit further. For most of my adult life here in the United States, every social movement that arose, whether it was anti-racism or anti-sexism or struggles for more kindness, if you like, to our natural environment, ecological awareness, and all of that, these social movements were very careful not to confront capitalism, not to define themselves as anti-capitalists. They wanted women to be allowed into the capitalist society. They wanted African Americans to be allowed in. They wanted a capitalism that was kinder and gentler to the natural environment. They didn't confront capitalism. And that's not a surprise given the history of anti-communism and anti-socialism after World War II. But the big breakthrough for me was the Occupy Wall Street movement. In the autumn of 2011, that movement distinguished itself from all of the predecessors of the previous 40 years by putting the economic question front and center. The slogan, the 1% versus the 99%, was a dramatic statement, if you understood our history, that now the economy itself was no longer exempt, was no longer a taboo for criticism. They were going to say that one of the key problems causing our difficulties, right up to and including the crash of 2008 and 2009, was an unstable economic system producing unbearable inequality, and it had a name, and the name was capitalism. That opened everything up when suddenly people in every medium and large city in America set up tent colonies in downtown Greens to discover that they weren't alone, that people who were critical of capitalism existed in America by the millions. This recognition, if you like, this new awareness created, I think, the breakthrough that then made it so remarkable when Bernie Sanders accepted the label socialism, ran in this country, and proved again that there are millions of people who are in no way turned off or turned away by that label. And now you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and more people coming that are showing the same thing in different corners of the world, of the United States, excuse me. So I think you're seeing a kind of slumbering bear that has been hibernating under the taboo that everything left of the Democratic Party is somehow unthinkable, dangerous, and all of that, all of that's fading. It's fading with the age of the people who believe it, but it's also fading with a capitalism that isn't working for the majority of people. They know it, they see it, and I think you're going to see more and more of that coming in the weeks, months, and years ahead.
You mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She, of course, co-sponsored the Green New Deal resolution, and Bernie Sanders just recently put forward his version of a climate plan that shares a lot of aspects of the Green New Deal resolution. And it's been actually getting some media coverage. The Wall Street Journal had an opinion, an op-ed by the editorial board calling it Bernie's Green Leap Forward. And the byline was, cost $16 trillion, fracking banned, oil CEOs in jail. And it was actually not an unfavorable article covering this plan, which, you know, coming in the Wall Street Journal, I thought was quite remarkable. I don't know if you've seen the coverage of the plan or even details of the plan, but what is your opinion of it and how it works with this idea of saving the environment and addressing it through an economic program?
Well, I think that Bernie's to be congratulated. So are the other people that helped produce this idea. I think one of the things I can add to the conversation, perhaps, is to remind everyone that the name they chose is not accidental. Mm-hmm. It's a very important name because it shows Americans who pay attention that it is not a new idea. The new part is the word green. The old part are the words New Deal, because that's what it was back in the 1930s when Franklin D. Roosevelt, also a Democratic presidential person in office, made the decisions under pressure from people below to overcome unemployment by putting 15 million people to work building parks, building buildings, building our national parks, doing some of the first conservation work in American history, building canals, doing very useful social things that we are benefiting from even now, 80 years later. I think they're recognizing that this was a way to get us out of the Great Depression by putting people back to work, by helping the people in the middle at the bottom, and not only bailing out those at the top. So it has a pedigree, it has a history in the United States, and it's a way of people like Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie and others to both say, let's do something new and different, and then also to show that it isn't all that new. And let me commend the Wall Street Journal. They correctly see that a big infrastructure program or a Green New Deal is a way to save the capitalism, which without those things is not looking good anymore. Many people understand that the New Deal saved American capitalism, even though it was opposed by the leading capitalists who had to be saved from their own system by their own, because of their own short-sightedness. Something like that is happening now, and the Wall Street Journal is smart enough to see it. Here's my concern. If you don't change the system beyond a Green New Deal, beyond a public employment job, if you don't change the way power is distributed so it isn't in the hands of a tiny group of shareholders, boards of directors, then what you risk is even if you get the New Deal of the 1930s, in the 50 years afterwards, we lost the New Deal because the capitalists took it back. If we just create another one, they will still be in the position to take it back, which is why this time you have to go further. You have to take that word socialism another step to make sure that the people are in charge of the economy after the New Deal, so it can't be undone like the old New Deal was.
Finally, Richard, what are your thoughts about the upcoming election? Because in many ways, Just as 2016 was a sort of referendum on the state of the economy, I think 2020 might be even more so. And we're seeing some of this play out in the Democratic debates, the very large field of Democratic candidates, some of the centrist members of which are quite upset about some of the what they see as radical leftists who are going to, you know, hand the election to Trump. With increasing affiliation or affinity, I should say, from Americans towards some of the ideas that Sanders and Warren and others are presenting, what do you hope is going to play out over the next year? Given that we unfortunately dependent on the mainstream media to set the debate and the parameters of the debates on these issues.
Well, I think, first of all, that more and more independent media like Pacifica, but the whole world of YouTube, of social media, and so on, are allowing information to be distributed in radically new ways outside of the control of the mainstream media, to their mounting distress, I might add. So I'm a bit more hopeful than I used to be about it. But let me answer your question about the upcoming election. Here's what I foresee, and I welcome it: a sharpening difference between the right wing of the Democratic Party and the left wing. The center is disappearing into that divide. And it's very clear in my mind that the mass of the American people have rejected the old traditional parties, Republican and Democrat, because neither of them protected the New Deal, the good deal that the working class in America got out of the Great Depression. All of that was undone by a succession of both Republican and Democratic presidents, including Mr. Clinton, so that it is clear to me that one of the reasons Mr. Trump did not lose the voters who would have otherwise turned away from a person like that was because, however awful he was and has since proven himself to be, it was intolerable to continue to vote between Republicans and Democrats who really made little difference other than in the pace of what they took away from the American people. And I think that any effort by the Democrats to put forward a candidate who looks or tastes or smells like the good old thing, and unfortunately that's Mr. Biden number one, will be rejected. He's not electable. The real opportunity for the Democrats is to say, we have something really different, in the kind of way that Trump insisted he was really different. He turns out to be not very different at all, another Republican, only more extreme and irascible. The Democrats, however, have to learn that they're going to have to be something new, something different, and something genuine, or else they're not going to have a chance. And the only way to do that at this point is to make yourself the emblem of a real break with the old America, of the established parties, of the wealthy becoming wealthier at the expense of everybody else, of the benefits of the New Deal, whether they are medical insurance or Social Security or a jobs program or a minimum wage, not allow them to continue to be eaten away. A socialist is a way of saying, this is a dramatic break, I am going in a new direction, and I think you will see that there is a groundswell of support that will come to a Bernie or whoever else carries that mantle, because the time for that has come. That's what the Gallup polls are telling us. That's what the statements by those business leaders are forcing them to recognize. Let's not lose courage and go with the right wing of the Democratic Party. That way goes backwards and to failure. We ought to go the other way.
Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us. As always, really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate yours as well.
My guest has been Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University in New York, professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.